You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The United States often presents itself as the world's major promoter and even guarantor of human rights. But as historian and foreign policy analyst James Peck argues, our rhetoric on human rights is sometimes used as a potent ideological weapon that has little to do with rights and everything to do with furthering America's global reach. His book is called Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here.
So how would you define the phrase human rights?
I think human rights is a phrase that emerged out of the Second World War, and it became rapidly identified in the United States and then very prominently in the 1970s as something to do with what we would call individual and civil and political rights. And it's much easier for us to understand it in those terms. And the individual rights have a great deal of positive aspects, whether it's
women's rights. About freedom of speech.
Yeah, freedom of speech and gay rights and women's rights, the civil rights movement. But there's another component of human rights, which I try to raise in the book, which is what I call a second current, which is that the question of basic human needs and meeting those needs, the issue of collective mobilization and mass resistance that has led to, in the end, the emergence of the other aspects of human rights. In other words, the human rights would have had a very difficult time emerging in the United States if the civil rights movement had not first succeeded. Human rights would have had a very difficult time emerging in Europe if the colonialization struggles had not first succeeded. So in my book, I try to suggest the ways that human rights is actually a much more complex and contradictory tradition than has been used by the American government.
But when I think back to some of the human rights co-opting, as you would call it, over the years, the Carter administration's pressure on Latin America, which has led to the democratization of pretty much all the countries there, the pressure on South Africa that helped to end apartheid, the pressure on the Soviet Union that led to a lot of people being allowed to emigrate, and we can go on and on and on. Is this co-opting a bad thing?
Human rights has both very positive and, in terms of American power, some very negative things. I think if one goes back to 1945 and they take that moment when the United States emerged as the supreme power on the planet and emerged as the embodiment of sort of the free world, and its kind, the freedom that it spoke of was a freedom that was not about equality or meeting issues of equality. It was not about redistribution of wealth and power. It was about certain kinds of formal freedoms and the rest. And those freedoms, as it came to Soviet dissidents and to certain issues in Latin America, are very, very positive ones. But they're only a part of the story. And it's the part the American government knows how to use extremely well.
So you're saying individual civil rights and broader economic and cultural rights have become separated.
Yes.
But that they all should be put under the same heading, human rights.
They should be put
under. But is that what – I remember I had a friend who was a communist. Not me, but my friend. And whenever we talked about civil rights or the freedom of speech in the Soviet Union, she would come back with, but housing is a lot less expensive and everybody gets health care. Of course, the health care was terrible, but that was a whole other matter. We'll still hear that same sort of thing from people who live in totalitarian societies where certain things are given and other things are not given.
Yes. One of the great
Hugo Chavez, for example.
One of the great problems has been the polarization of what human rights is about. And the Cold War, in a way, dichotomized them. We had freedom on certain sides. We spoke of equality on the other. We spoke of a right of free speech in the United States. We spoke of basic needs and jobs being guaranteed, however artificially, admittedly, in the Soviet Union. And that became part of the ideological struggles of the time. And as long as the – up through the era of Vietnam, that really was the reigning conception. One of the key questions is why – and the book tries to go into that and does go into that – why in the 70s human rights emerged – publicly in the United States. After all, it was a notion that was known, the UN Declaration of 1948, but it was not a common term used in the United States.
It's more rights something the French would have used.
It's something the French used. It's something the Europeans occasionally used. But by and large, it was not a widely used term in the United States until the Vietnam era.
But isn't it implied in the Declaration of Independence?
You know, the Declaration of Independence is not it doesn't use the phrase human rights.
Well, it says we declare these rights.
It declares these rights. And in many ways, the American Revolution was about natural rights, not human rights. And natural rights are actually a much more potent and revolutionary form because they basically say there are certain things we have, whether we're involved in certain economic or political structures, and we should have them now.
The things that you're talking about really began with Jimmy Carter, didn't they?
Yes.
Why then?
I think there are two really basic reasons why human rights emerged in the United States in the 1970s. First was the cataclysmic impact of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War really shattered the idealism of the Cold War. And it also brought right into the mainstream, because these were also the years which things were brought onto television. It was the era when the newscast became 30 minutes long. And Vietnam broke the old Cold War consensus about what the United States was doing and unleashed a torrent of criticism about what the United States was. Why was it doing this? What was the nature of its power? And in a way, Vietnam began sort of a systemic critique of what the United States was doing globally. That was the public side. But within the national security establishment, there was another problem. And that was that the old reigning anti-communist conceptions were seen as no longer particularly adequate. And a new idealism was required. And that idealism, in the end, was human rights. It's important to remember that it was, though it first appears with the Soviet dissidents, in terms of the Soviet dissident movement, and it first is discussed in the halls of Congress, Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski brought it to the fore before the emergence of major American human rights groups.
Now, human rights were also cited in our support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. That didn't turn out all that well. And right now, many people are arguing in the case of Libya that we should get more engaged. And others are saying, you know, we have no idea who we would be supporting, whether... not that Gaddafi, almost anything would be better than Gaddafi, but would we just be bringing in some other kind of dictator if we get rid of Gaddafi?
I think there are a couple of excruciatingly painful situations involved in Libya. First, obviously the Libyan people are suffering greatly. It makes an enormous amount of sense to provide some sort of humanitarian assistance, preferably through the UN and not through Western powers.
But that's not going to happen. You know, there's not going to be a no-fly zone as long as we depend on the UN because there are some countries that resist that approach.
Well, this is one of the revealing aspects of the history of human rights, which is why after Yugoslavia, why after Rwanda, why after all these things, there is no group within the UN that's empowered to do this. The reason is not because other nations oppose it so much as the U.S. and other powers have not been willing to give to the UN the authority to independently operate in such situations. This I think, would be the only possible hope. In a situation like Libya, the proclivity to get involved in the intricate affairs which we know very little about and often cause an enormous amount of harm is very high.
Well, if right now Germany and Russia are opposed to a no-fly zone, while France and the Arab League have endorsed it, does it matter whether the United States takes a strong position on that or not?
I think a no-fly zone, if it were sanctioned by the UN, may have a place. It's important with the Arab League, a statement that's very hard to get hold of. The Arab League's statement is that it must be done through the UN. They also insist that any other way would be foreign intervention. Now, in the Middle East today, we're watching, I think, something quite extraordinary, which is a vast movement, which I think will have as much impact in the end as the disintegration of the Soviet Union. because it's bringing back to the forefront what I would consider the more second aspects of the currents of human rights. It's not just free speech that's important. That's terribly important. It's not just stopping torture. That's terribly important. But back on the agenda are issues of the radical extremes of wealth and power and how you deal with those, how you meet people's basic needs, how you, for example, begin to think of a societal arrangement that's not simply structured through profit and the market. All these things, which were historically part of what I call the second current, are coming back to the fore.
My guest is James Peck, who's written a book called Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Well, in all of these discussions, we're reminded that we went into Iraq. One of the justifications was human rights. And I wonder if there's a way that military intervention and humanitarian intervention can truly be the same thing.
I think not. And I think you've raised a question that goes right to the heart of one of the challenges in thinking about human rights in the United States. Because when human rights emerged in the 1970s, it veered away from the basic preoccupations of the peace movement in the United States. That the peace movement, as well as, say, Martin Luther King and raising certain questions about wealth and power in the civil rights movement, had gone directly into the question of war, aggression, occupations, and nation building. And what happened in the rise of human rights, and it's developed over the last 30 years, is human rights, as you probably know, takes no stand on aggression. They take no stand on war. They're not against war. They're in favor of following the laws of war. They're not against occupation. They're for following the laws of occupation.
You're talking about Human Rights Watch and similar organizations.
Yes, but is
war even within their stated mission? Isn't their stated mission to defend people who are oppressed?
I would say that people like Martin Luther King Jr. and the rest would have found that a remarkable division and an unacceptable one. That a war is fundamentally one of the most egregious forms of violation of human rights. And indeed, as Nuremberg said, unleashes all the other evils that come that we've had to face since the 1945.
Well, we went into Yugoslavia, for example, with military force. Hasn't that worked out? Hasn't that been ultimately a good humanitarian effort?
Well, I would object to the use of humanitarian. Doctors Without Borders, I think, has probably put it much better. If you want to go to war, call it war, but don't call it humanitarian war. A humanitarianism that kills people is nobody's idea of humanitarianism. Now, of course, the human rights groups are split on this issue, but I think the Yugoslavian issue raises other issues which have to do with whether efforts should have been made to try to keep Yugoslavia together as a nation. Because once a nation begins to break asunder and goes into civil war, it's very difficult to stop the atrocities which follow.
The other day, John McCain endorsed a no-fly zone in Libya, saying, "We all say that we support the universal rights of the Arabs and Muslims in countries across the Middle East and North Africa who are inspiring us all in their quest for greater freedom, opportunity, and justice. But Libya is the real test. It is the test of whether we will provide our support not just when it is easy, but when it is difficult, when it requires more of us than just speeches and expressions of solidarity." Isn't he also saying the United States promotion of democracy in the region is being tested at this moment?
Well, I don't think the United States has been supporting democracy in the region for decades. I'd say quite the opposite. I'd say we call it democratization, but actually what we're talking about is trying to shape internal social forces in ways that would be effectively linked to our markets and to our certain of our NGOs and the rest. That's not democracy. Democracy is the capacity of a people in a nation to make the fundamental decisions about the allocation of their resources and the structure of their government.
Well, whatever the justification people may find for or against the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, don't they have more democracy now?
No. I don't think it's a question of more or less. I don't think they had it before, and I don't think they have it now. But going to war as a justification for democracy is neither a healthy thing for Iraq or Afghanistan. And it's a reminder of something that Senator Fulbright said years ago, If you're going to launch preemptive wars on the grounds that you're spreading democracy or human rights, you're going to find yourself losing your own.
So what would you have proposed in the case of Rwanda, where the genocide went unopposed?
The situation, I would have favored the preexistence of a UN force, which should have been there long before, that would indeed have had a genuine kind of autonomy. And yet one of the frustrations, and perfectly understandable for questions like you're asking, is that there is a history to these things. And one of the things that happens again and again is we don't stop and think about what the history is that's caused, say, the genocide. When Rwanda was placed under the shock economic treatment in the late 1980s, when the United States began to speak of quote-unquote democratization that was going to occur throughout Africa, they unleashed a series of economic clashes and social and ethnic clashes that gradually went out of control. And this was also in a context in which a major invasion of Rwanda was taking place from Uganda that was probably backed by the Americans to remove French influence. So you will start to say to somebody, excuse me, there are millions of people dying, and you're talking geopolitics.
But wait a minute, and I have to go to a break, but 800,000 people to a million people were killed, mostly Tutsis by Hutus. There were some, and Hutu sympathizers were also killed. And you're saying that really this is the fault of the United States and U.S. policies?
I'm saying that the structure, that the immediate, the United States had no desire to see a genocide break out. But the policies of the United States and the Western powers are directly related to many of the things that happened that led to that explosion. Just as the invasion, when Paul Kagame, who was the president of Rwanda today, was flown back from the United States to lead the invasion force from Uganda, that's not that the United States was not involved. Of course they were involved. The issue has to do with the way when these things get out of control, you have some way to deal with them. And they don't exist at the moment. The age of Western interventionism, especially in the Middle East, is coming to an end. That's not going to be possible anymore without arousing even further problems.
My guest is James Peck, whose latest book is Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights as Part of the American Empire Project at Metropolitan Books. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with James Peck. His latest book is called Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights. It's published by Metropolitan Books. The protest movements in Egypt and Tunisia have both been largely secular and so far appear to be dedicated to moving their countries towards democracy. What do you make of the U.S.'s response to those events so far?
I think the United States' concern is twofold, to appear to be supportive of movements towards democracy, and secondly, to make sure that they don't go very far. What that means is support for the basic stabilization of the military and not to encourage the unleashing of the kinds of demands economically and socially and politically that a desperately poor country is increasingly going to have to face, and which in a way are rather encouragingly the ones that are now on the agenda. And the interesting combination today is we are in a different world of the media and the web and the instant images of things, and perhaps a million youth in Egypt who became involved. And on the other hand, the workers and the people who are poorly employed and near destitute, the part of the great issue is how these factors are going to come together and ways to encourage those in a more democratic direction. But they're going to find that, I think, themselves.
Well, it was pointed out, at least by some critics, that the Obama administration was rather slow to react. There were a lot of pressures from the right, people like John Bolton saying that we should be supporting our friends like Mubarak. And then it was pointed out that To the protesters, it was not insignificant that those tear gas canisters said made in USA.
Well, there's no question the kind of support the United States has given Mubarak and others in the region, and above all, and perhaps most important, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. But I think there's another piece in here when we speak of the Boltons and the John McCain quote which you read, which is there has been a long history in the national security establishment. It goes back to the Carter administration. That the most hawkish of hawks tend to often be the strongest supporters, ideologically, of human rights. And that should, so when Brzezinski, in the Carter years, became its foremost advocate, this should not have surprised us, because they're really talking about a way of envisioning a concept of rights through what I call the first Corinthian war, gradual, moderate, a step-by-step change, and a way of judging changes that break from that, say a more radical redistribution or even nationalizing something, as a violation of rights.
Do we sometimes assume that the rest of the world agrees with us on everything? For example, I'm thinking about Paul Wolfowitz, who just recently came out for intervention in Libya, earlier said that American forces would be greeted with rose petals as they marched into Baghdad. And I even remember a New Yorker cartoon some around that time where these people were having drinks on a terrace in a fancy high rise. And one of the – oh, this is after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And one of the people saying to the other, you know, if those Taliban were at this party, I'm sure that they would really appreciate this and they would stop doing all of this nasty stuff.
I think one of the greatest illusions the United States has is the belief that we really are the global thinkers about the world and that the other attitudes towards it are somewhat provincial. I would actually turn that somewhat around. I think the United States lives in a sort of a self-contained ideological conception which it projects more onto the world than it understands that world. There's a line that Senator Fulbright, who I edited in the 1980s, used to say, which I think was a very apt one. He said, Americans can never quite remember what other people can never forget. And I think that's a real way to get some insight into the kind of world we live in. There are things we do in our history and our politics and our ways our national security has functioned for 60 years that to an Arab who has any reasonable understanding fully remembers. They don't forget. Perhaps it would help a little if they forgot a little, but they don't. And so the notion of rose petals is like the opposite of that kind of understanding.
My guest is James Peck, whose most recent book is the one we're discussing, Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights. It's published by Metropolitan Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that American human rights reports on the Middle East follow the same pattern as human rights reports about every other area of the globe. Praise of Washington's principles followed by criticism of its operational policies. How does that play out?
In other words, what we say is if only we lived up to our ideals, if only we lived up to our human rights policies, then our policies would be okay. For example, the Human Rights Watch people, when George Bush began his agenda of freedom, and called for more democratic governments in the Middle East, the Human Rights Watch said, this is a great idea. Now, just live up to it. Now, the problem with that is you're taking what is the American ideological rhetoric and turning it into ideals rather than seeing it within what I try to do in the book, a long 50-year span of ideological warfare, which is understood as that. To gain certain American objectives. Now, it's notable in a way that this is much more something American organizations do than, say, Amnesty International, which, of course, is London-based. Their attitude has been that the problems actually are more endemic in the United States than simply a question of living up to its ideals.
But I would hate to imagine a world in which we didn't have Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International because I would be unaware of all sorts of things that are going on that I should know about.
I think they play and can play a far better role than they do today. And I think they do play a useful role. And they point out enormous violations of rights in torture, imprisonments, All of these things are very, very good. But what would be most useful to expand their role would be for them to develop a way of articulating their arguments that does not parallel the language of the American government. You know,
Say their missions have evolved over time. So what was Human Rights Watch's original mission, and has it changed because of change in leadership or because of they're dealing with the real world?
Well, I think the original mission of Human Rights Watch was to raise the to deal with the excruciating and painful dictatorships that were evident within South and Central America, and to try to end the extreme torture that was evident in those areas. It should be remembered the real first 9/11 was the overthrow of Salvador Allende. And the Allende coup in 1973 is in some ways the beginning of an effort of human rights language, because the human rights organizations really in the United States, Human Rights Watch, doesn't really begin until the late Carter years. Amnesty, of course, begins in 1961, but Human Rights Watch is much later. And I think that the effort was to try and both focus to create a coalition that would both critique the Soviet Union and its dissidents, but also to pull back from the most egregious violations of American power.
But haven't they been critical of any number of things the United States has been involved with? For example, Human Rights Watch is in the forefront of criticism about Guantanamo. Earlier, they were there with Abu Ghraib.
Yes, and these are extraordinarily valuable things to have done. And yet again, I would say there's a difference between the way an Amnesty has raised it and a Human Rights Watch, because a Human Rights Watch really can basically only say, why is this happening? Why aren't we living up to our values? Why aren't we living up to our ideals? Amnesty's approach is different. Amnesty says, let's look at the history. Let's look at Abu Ghraib and go back to certain things that were done with renditions, that were done with Phoenix program in the Vietnam War, that were done earlier in Central America in the 50s. In other words, they put it in a broader historical context, not just a violation of ideals. And so if you're going to really broaden the notion of human rights so that you can truly get a far more expansive conception of what's possible in terms of social and economic change, a vision not all that far from certain things Martin Luther King said when he said, if you're going to have peace and you must bring it together with civil rights, and you must lead to a major transformation of the structures of wealth and power. But to do that, you need a different language than the language of the American government. The two overlap far too much.
Well, the so-called war on terrorism is often described as a war of ideas. Is one of those ideas our promotion of human rights and democracy?
I don't think it's the American idea to do that. The war on terror is a highly mobilizing and mobilized phrase, which, again, Human Rights Watch questioned whether it was a war. And they questioned it well, and they cautioned about the problem. But as you know from looking at the book, Amnesty does not use the word terrorism, and nor does the BBC. And there's an implication that's to be drawn from that, which is the word terrorism suggests a sort of global, coordinated group of people which justifies the massive American military expenditures and globalistic response. Take the word away. See these acts as murder, bombings, slaughter, whatever you wish to call it. They don't have that same coordinated feeling. It's a different vision of a world. The human rights one is much more compatible with Washington.
Well, how should we see the expansionism and all the terror that was created by the great dictatorships of the 20th century in Germany, in the Soviet Union, in China? Did we fight Hitler because he was invading other countries, or should we have fought Hitler because he was killing millions of people?
It's hard to lump all those countries together, so let me respond specifically to Hitler
But there are human rights issues in all of them. In all cases, governments dehumanized people.
Yes, they certainly do. I think, as de Gaulle said, the state is a cruel monster, and it's true for all states, and it's true of the United States as well. That doesn't equate it with Hitler, but it's true of all states. The point about Hitler, and I think it's one usually forgotten about human rights, is there's a reason that Nuremberg described the war of aggression as the supreme crime leading to all others, including human rights. The problem with Hitler was probably that aggression was not stopped. If aggression had been stopped early, the genocide would not have occurred.
In other words, if the world had opposed Hitler
early
when he
on.
Went into Czechoslovakia or been more aggressive in the resistance with Poland.
Yes, the real problem is aggression. And that is not a human rights issue. And that's why that's why the issues of war and peace are central, just as the issues of occupation are central. If you're occupying a country like Iraq and you're dealing with the resistance that occurs in a situation like that and you say, excuse me, the problem is you're violating the wars of occupation, not occupation. Now, when Martin Luther King and others and Fulbright and many of the more radical critics looked at Vietnam, their question had to do with the basic effort you were undertaking, not whether you were violating simple norms as you undertook it. That's partly what's lost when you make what I call the first current of rights a much too legalistic one.
So what should we be doing, for example, in Burma with Aung San Suu Kyi or in Sudan where there are still problems, even though the South has been given independence, Darfur remains an area where people are dying and will continue to die. Do we just sit by or do we say, okay, well, let's apply a few economic sanctions, which usually don't work?
The last thing we're doing is sitting by. If we really spent as much time watching the flow of corporate funds, as sometimes you can do fictionally in Jean Le Carré, or if you were to really look at the arms purchases and flow of arms into those areas and who's doing it and why, if you really looked at the bank accounts and the rest, you'd be doing some pretty important and valuable research that would be more effective than some of the more, I would say, hopeful and idealistic calls.
Did we learn anything from the WikiLeaks?
I think we've learned from the WikiLeaks that that many of the specifics that we'd expected about the American government and the way it operates are fully evident. I mean, one of the things that a diplomatic historian, I'm a historian and I read documents, I read them for years. Usually you read more dry ones. These are sometimes witty and they're funny and they get to the point and they suggest. But what they do not have is any thoughtful conception, because they're reporters, really. I mean, they're diplomatic reporters, of how American power might actually operate differently.
And how might it operate differently in 10 seconds?
It has to pull back and realize that there are 80% of the rest of the planet that's non-white that is struggling to find in their own way, and often in conflicting rights ways, a more just society than the world they've grown up in.
James Peck's book, Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights, is published as part of the American Empire Project of Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.